You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Casualty, Grey's Anatomy, New Amsterdam, ER, House, we all love a medical drama. But we're not so keen as a rule on medical dramas in our own lives. For a nation still feeling a bit bruised by the aftermath of the COVID pandemic, the news in January that a person in the United States had died from H5N1 bird flu wasn't exactly comforting. SBS spoke to Michelle Villa, a senior research fellow at the Centre for Pathogen Genomics at the University of Melbourne, to find out whether Australians were in any actual danger. It turns out Australia is one of the few places in the world where H5N1 is not endemic. But even so, it's wise to take precautions.
The most recent assessment by the Quadripartite, it came out in December, still suggests that the risk of avian influenza infection to the general public remains low, but it is higher for occupationally exposed workers, okay? These are people who would interact with infected animals. So for the average person, our risk is quite low, but if you have chickens and they're sick, it's important to get those animals tested and know your risk.
But while we seem to be off the hook for bird flu, at least for now, would we be ready for another pandemic 5 years after COVID? Professor Paul Kelly, the man who helped lead Australia's COVID-19 public health response, told SBS he's not so sure. He worries people may not accept another vaccine program.
The trust is hard to win and easy to lose. And I think that will be a major issue for us going into the next pandemic. The Australian public was enormously trusting of medical advice and the politicians that were in charge of at the national and the state and territory level. I'm not sure that that's the case now.
Also in January, the federal government unveiled Australia's first ever national autism strategy, a $42 million plan to improve inclusion, access and outcomes for Australians with autism. Advocates are calling it a game changer, offering hope and much needed support for families across the country who face unique and daily challenges. Making the announcement, the Minister for Social Services, Amanda Rishworth, said communities from migrant backgrounds were identified as a priority cohort to address unique barriers that they face.
Whether that is through the peer support, whether it is through being very conscious of asking people how they would like to be communicated in different government systems, making sure that we have resources in language is some of the initiatives that we have committed to make sure there is a priority for linguistically and culturally diverse people.
With more than 400,000 Australians identified by the government as living with dementia, not surprisingly, there was interest in a new blood test being trialled in the UK to detect the early signs of dementia. In the study at the University of Oxford, blood samples are scanned for a series of proteins, biomarkers associated with dementia, that can provide early diagnosis. Professor Karen Jane Anstey from the University of New South Wales says while medications can assist people in the early stages of dementia, there's still not a cure.
They don't prevent or stop the disease progression. So the medications that are available now are really effective in the earlier stages of dementia and they are more to treat symptoms.
Lung cancer is Australia's fifth most diagnosed cancer but causes the greatest number of deaths because it's often diagnosed too late. A new screening program is now available that hopes to detect cases much earlier for those at the highest risk, which includes Indigenous Australians and some migrant communities. Scans to detect lung issues normally cost hundreds of dollars, but Health Minister Mark Butler announced that from July they would cost nothing for patients deemed to be at high risk of lung cancer.
So in addition to rolling this program out nationally in the usual way, allowing people to go to their doctor and get referred for a CT scan at a place like Benson here, we'll also from later this year be rolling out trucks into regional communities with cutting-edge CT, mobile CT technology to ensure that every single Australian, no matter where they live in the country, has access to this world-leading program.
In July, health experts were calling for more early action to prevent another of Australia's most common causes of death, diabetes. The Royal Australian College of GPs urged Australians to see their doctor and make steps to change their lifestyle now to avoid long-term health struggles in later life. The George Institute for Global Health, based in New South Wales, was also pushing for a sugar tax and subsidies on fresh fruits and vegetables to help these lifestyle changes. Lead author and research associate Tasman Davis says meaningful changes to diets can be achieved by taxes and subsidies.
So the World Health Organization strongly recommends that countries consider taxes on sugary drinks. We know that over 100 countries have implemented taxes on sugary drinks, and there's very strong evidence that these taxes can lower people's sugar consumption. So I think if we're getting serious about tackling type 2 diabetes, I think a tax on sugary drinks is a no-brainer. It's never the case that one policy is a silver bullet. We really need a suite of policies to best shift people's diets. And I think subsidies are also needed.
Around 4 million Australians, or one in five, are living with chronic pain. Many report feeling overlooked and ignored within the healthcare system, prompting experts to call for greater national investment, including a more holistic approach to care. A report by Chronic Pain Australia found this year, 2025, 54% of survey respondents reported waiting more than 2 years for a diagnosis, and 44% waited more than 3 years. The organisation's chairperson, Nicolette Ellis, told SBS chronic pain costs our economy more than cardiovascular disease, cancer and diabetes combined.
Chronic pain is a complex condition to treat, and it usually needs a team of health professionals with different skill sets to help build that person's toolkit. Unfortunately, in the National Pain Report, we saw that only 18% of people are referred to what we call multidisciplinary care, where they can get access to those different health professionals to help support their care.
It emerged this year that Australia really is the allergy capital of the world. Hay fever affects around 24% of Australians, food allergy around 7%, and allergy to drugs around 5%. Australia also has the highest rates of food allergy in childhood anywhere globally. And for some people, that allergy isn't just a case of sneezing or a nasty rash, unpleasant though they can be. For someone suffering an anaphylaxis reaction, that allergy can be life-threatening. A report by Deloitte puts the price tag of managing the condition to be at least $2,400 a person and $18.9 billion nationally. Professor Kirsten Perrott, the director of Australia's National Allergy Centre of Excellence, says the report shows there's a need for greater investments in research and services to treat and prevent rising rates of allergy in Australia.
Allergic disease has not been given the attention that it deserves, and this report shows that allergic disease is a hugely significant problem for Australians, affecting one in three Australians. That's almost every household. And I think that this report shows that more attention is required, and certainly sustained investment in the National Allergy Council and the National Allergy Centre of Excellence to help prevent allergies, help improve the safety of those with allergic disease, to accelerate research and deliver better care. That's what we really need.
Controversy has swirled around the in vitro fertilisation sector this year. Two serious mistakes were reported at Monash IVF. One woman was implanted with another couple's embryo, and another received her own partner's embryo by mistake. At Melbourne IVF and IVF Australia, there were errors in the family lists given to sperm donors, with some donors getting the wrong information about children born from their donations. And Genea, one of Australia's biggest fertility clinic groups, suffered a cybersecurity breach. Sensitive patient data was exposed and reportedly published on the dark web. IVF is more than just a medical service. It's deeply personal, and mistakes can have lifelong implications for the child born, for the parents, and for donor-conceived people. Adelaide woman Isabel Lewis was among those whose data was stolen. She was horrified that her personal information had been illegally shared online.
It makes me feel like privacy is dead. You know, fertility treatment is probably the most invasive and emotional medical treatment. I've had, treatment for mental health stuff, and I'd probably be less concerned about that being on the dark web. But this is so, like, it kind of cuts deep into your emotional, ness of why you want to be a parent, your journey there.
Genea Fertility has consistently apologised for the breach. As a result of a government review of the sector, a new independent accreditation body is to be set up by January 2027, policing national standards for fertility clinics. For most of us, the main point of contact with the health services is our own GP. October's Health of the Nation industry survey of almost 2,500 GPs shows a growing number of general practitioners are managing patient conditions typically handled by specialists. That means having to see patients for longer appointments to treat more complex medical needs. WA-based GP Ramya Raman, who's also Vice President of the Royal Australian College of GPs, says that's not a bad thing.
When patients are able to see their GP and spend time with their GPs, it actually means that they don't end up in hospital. So, best to see their GP rather than walking into the hospital.
But she says it's important that GPs are funded to do that work. And the year ended with another funding row, this time over hospitals. In 2023, the federal and state governments agreed a new funding model for public hospitals, which would see the Commonwealth increasing its share of public hospital costs to 42.5% by 2031. But state premiers and territory chief ministers have teamed up to accuse the federal government of backflipping on its promise on public hospital funding. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says the latest offer from the federal government is just 37% of the costs, which he says is a massive decline.
The federal government's got a lot of far deeper pockets than the states do, but we're responsible for service delivery, and we need a new deal here because what's being offered is just not good enough.
As Benjamin Franklin didn't quite say, in this world nothing can be said to be certain except death, taxes and rows about health service funding. Alan Lee, SBS News.